It's Monday, and this is The Takeaway for April 29th. I'm Tanzina Vega. A deadly shooting at a synagogue on the last day of Passover reveals another link between anti-Semitism and online havens for extremists.
We're collecting digital evidence, and we're aware of his manifesto.
We take on the debate about extremism and free speech on the internet. Also on this podcast, Canada legalized marijuana in the fall, but the rollout has not been smooth.
We're growing in massive greenhouses, and that method of growing hasn't really been done before at a scale like this.
And finally, a documentary about Holocaust survivors seeks to tell their stories in a way that resonates with younger audiences.
There's only so much you can get from a textbook and from the same photos that you see again and again. And I think we've come to accept so much of the detail of the Holocaust without interrogating it anew each time.
A lot to get to today, so let's get started. It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. On Saturday morning, a gunman opened fire at the Chabad of Poway Synagogue in Southern California, where the congregation was gathered on the final day of Passover. One woman was killed and three others were injured. The shooter was white and he reportedly yelled anti-Semitic language when he entered the synagogue. The attack came 6 weeks after a shooter killed 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, and 6 months to the day from the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where 11 people were killed. All three attacks have digital connections, online forums that provide a place for hate to thrive and which have inspired terrorism. Before the Poway shooting, a user claiming to be the gunman apparently posted a link to a manifesto on the online message board 8chan.
8chan is a fairly large website. A number of things go on there.
Robert Evans is an investigative journalist with the research collective Bellingcat.
8chan's whole board is where this person and the Christchurch shooter both announced the start of their massacre. And Poll is essentially a neo-Nazi gathering place on the internet. And the goal of the users there is to radicalize each other further and further and eventually convince other people to carry out attacks like this.
So if these sites are breeding hate, the question is whether enough is being done to track and respond to the spread of white nationalism online. Since taking office, President Trump has cut funding to an Obama-era program designed to combat domestic terrorism. To put all this in context, we turn to Hannah Block Wiebe, an assistant professor of law at Drexel University, and Robert Evans, the investigative journalist we heard from earlier. Robert started by laying out the evidence connecting the shooter with the 8chan post.
The post includes a link to the manifesto. The manifesto has the shooter's name in it, and the name has been, you know, confirmed pretty early on. The language is all sort of what you'd expect for a case like this. It included a live stream link, which thankfully did not work for very long. It was a pretty open and shut case as far as I'm concerned.
Robert, 8chan tweeted on Sunday about the original post, and I'll read you what they said. They said the Poway shooter's post on 8chan was taken down 9 minutes after creation. There are only screen caps available and no archives exist since the post was deleted so quickly. The loudest groups publicizing this crime and giving attention to this criminal are the fake news media. That's 8chan quoting their tweet there. Walk us through the response, Robert. What are they trying to say?
Oh, they're trying to say that they're not responsible because they deleted the original post. But when I got onto 8chan's poll board about an hour or so after the shooting, there were numerous people, other users of the site, posting screen grabs of the initial post that the shooter made, as well as sharing his manifesto and sharing the Christchurch shooter's manifesto and the video of the Christchurch shooter shooting. And in fact, when I started reporting on these people, I mean, I've been reporting on them for years, but when I reported on them in the wake of the Christchurch shooting, they first off sent off a death threat to me and put a bounty on my head. But they also would repeatedly post links to the video of the Christchurch shooting and the shooter's manifesto and brag to me that I could never get it taken down, that it was going to continue spreading on the internet and they were going to keep spreading it. And they're going to do the same thing with the Poway shooter's manifesto. Like, the fact that the leadership of the site claims that they took down the post quickly is meaningless, because they knew quite well that other users would continue to spread everything this person had posted.
Hannah, I want to bring you in here, because just listening to what Robert was saying about 8chan's response here, how do we explain how sites like 8chan are able to even stay up after posting content like this?
So under U.S. law, under the Communications Decency Act, an online forum can't be held liable for the unlawful content that its users post.
Cannot, correct?
Cannot. So what the government can actually do to prevent 8chan from continuing to enable these postings is highly limited. The U.S. government can't take the forum offline. It can't even take a specific sub-forum offline, and nor can it block access to the website, even though my understanding is that other governments around the world, including New Zealand and Australia, have done so.
Let's talk a little bit about the distinction also, which is there's a legal distinction between hate speech and true threats of violence. How does the law distinguish between those two? Because in my mind, one leads to the other in many instances.
Right. So the U.S. Supreme Court has held that hate speech is entitled to First Amendment protection, and Nazi speech is also entitled to First Amendment protection. Speech that incites violence, true threats, speech integral to criminal conduct are not protected. So the problem here is that you're absolutely right. It's difficult to draw boundaries between all of these categories, but the law that we have does attempt to draw these boundaries, even though sometimes one category of speech that's presumptively protected can provoke speech that is then unprotected and even outright violence, as we saw in this case.
Robert, let's talk about that distinction here. How do you interpret that?
You know, there was a case in Oregon in I think the mid to late 90s, the murder of a young immigrant named Mulugeta Sarraw. And the murder was directly inspired and provoked by a guy named Tom Metzger, who was the head of a neo-Nazi organization called White Aryan Resistance. And Metzger did not kill Sarraw or directly order his death, but he did radicalize the young men who beat him to death and urge them to commit crimes like the killing of Mulugeta Sarraw. And Metzger was eventually convicted of, I think the term used was vicarious responsibility for the crime. And he was sued for several million dollars successfully. Being able to do that to the owners or people running 8chan would be like, I don't think that the current law is set up to allow that. But in my mind, at least, if you're looking morally at what's going on this site, it is kind of the same thing. There's less of a direct hierarchy than there was with White Aryan Resistance, but there's certainly the same incitement to violence going on. So I think that what they're doing, I think that the people running the site, certainly, I would say, at least morally, have a vicarious responsibility for these shootings.
Hannah, is the government, is the U.S. government taking the threat of white nationalist online communities seriously enough now that we've seen the evidence that these communities have incited actual violence?
I don't think so. I think this attack should motivate the government to take white nationalist and white supremacist violence much more seriously as a threat to public safety, public order, and particularly to vulnerable groups. But instead, what we've seen is that there doesn't appear to have been a consistent effort or consistent successful effort to prevent these violent attacks. And instead, this is the second synagogue attack in 6 months. So to my mind, that means that the government should be using many more tools that it has at its disposal in order to prevent these violent acts from occurring.
Robert, I'm wondering here, there was a similar post made on 8chan by the shooter who killed 50 people in Christchurch, New Zealand, 6 weeks ago. The man who killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue was also celebrated on 8chan. Why aren't we asking where these folks are radicalized? Why do we use different language for domestic terrorists versus folks on the outside?
I mean, that's a very good question. And we don't all use different language. Within sort of the countering violent extremism community, the issue of sort of how Islamic terrorists are radicalized online and how right-wing terrorists are radicalized online, it's very similar, and we speak about them in similar ways. But they're dealt with very differently by our legal system and dealt with very differently by law enforcement. You know, Lieutenant Christopher Hassan, the Coast Guard member who was planning a massacre that seems fairly similar to some of these other massacres and was inspired by a lot of the same people. You know, he cited Anders Breivik as an inspiration for the massacre he was planning, who the Christchurch shooter and the Poway shooter also cited. Lieutenant Hassan was only caught before committing his massacre because he was buying drugs illegally online. And it looks like right now he's about to be let out early because the judge says they don't have enough to charge him with terrorism, even though he wrote out clearly on his work computer that he was planning a terroristic massacre.
Robert, I'm going to pause there because, Hannah, yeah. Given this example, the government doesn't have enough?
What the government has in order to charge Hassan might not be more than his posts online. And I think if we're looking to simple sort of online posts or manifestos without more, it sets a troubling precedent for the idea that the government could charge anyone for a crime based on something they've written. Obviously, there's sometimes a very strong connection between those writings and acts of violence. But where the government has investigated and hasn't turned up enough to have probable cause to charge someone, that suggests to me that either they're not doing their jobs or there really isn't anything there to support the idea that an attack was actually going to take place.
Robert, your thoughts on that? And should the government, what should the government do about sites like 8chan, in your opinion?
I mean, it's difficult to say, you know, when somebody writes out on a computer, I'm planning to kill these people, this is my goal, and I'm stock, and we also know that they're stockpiling weaponry. But it's also, it's not illegal to stockpile weaponry. It's not illegal to stockpile ammunition. It's not illegal to write out on your own private Word document plans to massacre people. So I agree, it's very difficult legally to charge these people. And I don't know what exactly is the solution to that going forward. But I will say, if Christopher Hassan was an Islamic extremist and had been planning an attack in that vein, I suspect more would be done. And I suspect more would be done to keep him behind bars. As far as what can be done to deal with this problem of online radicalization, I don't think anyone has a solid answer to that yet. I mean, I would like to see these gathering places no longer up and available, but that's almost an impossible goal because there's numerous web hosts all around the planet, many of whom would be happy to host a site like 8chan's poll board. We've had the same issue getting a neo-Nazi site called Stormfront off. You know, it's been successfully taken down for weeks at a time at some points, but they always find another server. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of similar to the problem that law enforcement has shutting down sites that distribute child pornography. There's always someone somewhere willing to host them. What I will say can be done and absolutely is within the power of American law enforcement to do is to monitor these sites better, is to try to track some of these people down, which they can do, is to be looking at these sites. A young woman was actually browsing 8chan's poll board when the shooter posted the link to his attack and his manifesto a half hour before the shooting began, and was desperately calling and also tweeting to on social media, reaching out to the FBI and calling them on the phone, trying to get someone to do something, and was unable to reach anybody and to get any action taken. In my mind, there should be law enforcement monitoring these places at all times. We know where they are. We know where they're trying to get people to radicalize and announce other attacks. Police should at least be watching them.
Robert Evans is an investigative journalist with the research collective Bellingcat. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
And Hannah Bloch-Wiebe is assistant professor of law at Drexel University. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
Six months ago, Canada became one of the few countries to fully legalize recreational marijuana. Expectations were high for a booming market and huge earnings. And yet, the budding legal weed market has been underwhelming at best for our northern neighbors. Black market sales are predicted to make up nearly three-quarters of Canada's marijuana sales in 2019. Vanmala Subramaniam is a cannabis reporter for the Financial Post in Ottawa. Vanmala, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So we said expectations were big. How big were expectations for legal recreational marijuana in Canada?
Well, expectations were coming from two sources. So from the point of view of consumers, I think they expected that on October 17th, 2018, the day that recreational weed became legal, that you would start being able to order weed and get weed in a matter of a few days. And that didn't happen. In a span of, say, a week or 2 weeks, the biggest online cannabis store in Ontario, the biggest province, was struggling with supply. So, you know, there was a backlog of orders. people weren't getting their weed in time. They had to wait 2 to 3 weeks at some points. The brand variations were just not there. The brands people wanted sold out very, very quickly. And then there were no retail stores open in the province. So the only means to order weed was online, and you couldn't get it quick enough. So that kind of made people fall back to the black market, or in some cases just criticize the government's legalization methods and the regulations surrounding legalization. Now, the second expectation came from the corporate side. So licensed producers, a lot of them are publicly listed on Canadian stock exchanges, they made it seem like there was going to be so much weed by October 17th because of the way they sold the amount of weed they were growing. Now, for multiple reasons, that weed that they were growing took a lot of time to come onto market. So you had expectations from both these sides. And I think from the consumer's point of view, at least, they were quite disappointed.
So you mentioned a couple things. First of all, 2 to 3 weeks for weed, that just seems outrageous for anything. We're so used to getting Amazon within 48 hours. I can see why that would trigger a reaction towards going back to the black market. What about taxes? Was this weed more expensive than what you would find on the black market?
Yes. So the way it works is the provinces collect 10% in an excise tax. So the licensed producers, so the cannabis companies, they price their weed. And on top of that, the consumer has to pay 10% in excise tax. And the price of weed, of legal weed in Canada to begin with, is higher than the black market. And that's due to multiple reasons. But one of the reasons is in the lead up to legalization, the black market decided that they would lower their price of weed in order to compete. Now, you have a higher price of weed and an excise tax of 10%. So that doesn't bode well for trying to get, I guess, erode the black market.
I'm just still trying to figure out, was it a question of not being prepared? I mean, how could you have Canadian government officials and also some of the largest weed manufacturers or procurers in the world not able to solve a pretty standard problem to have a product available when it comes on market?
So there are a number of reasons. Okay, so first of all, the licensing system by our Department of Health, Health Canada, is quite complicated. Some say it's cumbersome. So you have to go through multiple checks by inspectors in order to move from a cultivation license to a sales license. So there are a lot of processes here. But the other thing is we're growing in massive greenhouses, and that method of growing hasn't really been done before at a scale like this. So, you know, cannabis was an indoor plant because of prohibition. I think in areas like Northern California and Colorado was grown outdoors because of the weather. But in Canada, it was mostly indoor supply. And so you're trying to take this plant that hasn't really been researched, that doesn't have, you know, the genetic, I guess, resilience to be able to grow in a massive greenhouse and grow quickly. And you're trying to do this in a span of, say, a year or 2 years. And, you know, you're bound to encounter problems like mold, bug infection, and you can't use pesticides on weed in Canada because it is inhaled. So there are very strict restrictions around using pesticide. So you're bound to have crop failure. Now, what I think is happening is the licensed producers not being very transparent about the struggles that they have faced. So they've repeatedly told investors and told the public that there is going to be product on shelf by October 17th. And now we are, what, end of April? And we're still struggling with a big supply shortage. And, you know, the licensed producers are continuing to say, don't worry, by next year or by the end of 2019, we're going to meet our target. So what's happening is they keep pushing their deadlines and, in my opinion, not being very transparent over why exactly they're struggling to scale up.
Here in the United States, we have not legalized recreational marijuana countrywide. It's still a state-by-state question. But in states that have legalized recreational marijuana, I'm wondering if there are any, whether it's supply chain management issues or business issues that you might see that Canadian businesses can learn from, any lessons that we are doing well or vice versa?
Yeah, I think a really good example is Colorado, right? So what Colorado did is they gave existing medical marijuana growers the right of first refusal for licenses, which means that they gave them a choice. Do you want to join the legal market or do you not? And that cuts down on your potential source of black market production to begin with, right? In Canada, however, there were very restrictive rules around who would get licensed to grow. And there was a whole slew of existing black market growers, you know, just small micro cultivators who were just unable to get into the system because these big corporations kind of had the manpower, you know, the money, the capital to hire consultants to get their licensing done very quickly and scale up. And that left black market growers on the side. So just to be clear, we don't have a supply shortage of cannabis overall in Canada. We have a supply shortage of legal cannabis. There's a lot of, you know, illegal cannabis. You walk into any dispensary, even the one by my house here in Ottawa, and you can get a variety of products. There's never going to be a shortage. The issue is when you walk into a legal weed store, you might not be able to get the product you want.
Vanmala Subramaniam is a cannabis reporter for the Financial Post in Ottawa. Vanmala, thank you again.
Thank you.
The Chabad of Poway shooting on the last day of Passover this weekend was a stark example of the recent rise in anti-Semitism. And at the same time, the collective memory of the Holocaust is growing more distant.
We felt that it was important to make a documentary now because in 5-10 years' time, there simply won't be many Holocaust survivors left.
That's Arthur Carey, director of The Last Survivors, a documentary airing tomorrow on Frontline. I spoke with him on Friday before the shooting.
And I think that survivors are very conscious that they don't have much time left, and in many ways they're in a more reflective space now than they have been in the past. So a lot of what they experienced in the past that they have suppressed through their lives, they find it harder to suppress now. They've finished careers, their families have grown up and moved on, they're more isolated than they were before. So I think they're more vulnerable to memories of what happened to them in their childhood.
World War II ended more than 70 years ago, and Carey told me that as we get further away from the Holocaust, the gravity of what happened is getting lost.
I think people have become slightly desensitized to it. It's part of the curriculum here in the UK. I learned about the Holocaust when I was in school, but there's only so much you can get from a textbook and from the same photos that you see again and again. And I think we've come to accept so much of the detail of the Holocaust without interrogating it anew each time. And I think that absolutely younger generations think about it and know much less about it than older generations. So it feels like an important time to get people to re-engage with details from the past.
How do you make this story feel relevant for today's generation or younger generations?
I think what I wanted to do was to make the survivors feel relatable. So I didn't want to. There have been lots of documentaries made about the Holocaust in the past, and typically documentaries might be made around, you know, studio interviews and a lot of archive. And I really wanted to limit the amount of archive I used in the film and film as much as possible with people in their day-to-day lives, doing normal things, walking the dog, complaining about eating vegan food, dancing in their front room at home. I wanted to make them feel normal and relatable. And I think in that way, I hope people are able to empathize with them a little bit more so that you were learning about the Holocaust, but you were also learning about how trauma goes on affecting people and about how we find it hard to suppress traumatic memories from our past and they find a way to sort of rise to the surface.
Let's talk a little bit about how those traumatic experiences and that trauma did rise to the surface in the interviews when you were interviewing survivors.
Well, I intentionally looked for survivors that hadn't spoken much before. So for the majority of people in my film, this was really the first time that they had spoken in detail to a stranger about their past. You know, many of them had hardly spoken to their families either.
Why was that?
I think because when they, you know, came, these are all survivors who are based in the UK. When they first came over here, they wanted to get on with life as much as possible. I think also the British public didn't really want to ask them too many questions. They had just emerged from, you know, the Second World War and their own trauma. And so they weren't asked too many questions. They wanted to get on with life. They'd suffered incredible loss. Ivor, who's featured in the documentary, lost 7 siblings and both his parents.
I was in the settlement camp of Dachau in Germany in 1945, February. My birthday is in February, And I was bar mitzvah, which meaning they're 13 years old. And I remember going to the barbed wire across the border in the forest and seeing the birds fly by and thinking to myself, speaking to God, said, please God, let me get out of this hellhole. And I never ask another thing from you from your life. And as you could see, God answered my prayer, but I'm afraid I still keep on talking to God and asking for further help. But of course, that's a problem about being a survivor. Everything tends to remind you of something.
Only he and an older brother survived. And, you know, he moved to the UK once the camps were liberated and had a very successful career working in the clothing industry, running a factory. And I think that by keeping himself busy, by having four children and a happy marriage, he was able to distract himself and not think too much about what he'd lived through. But his children are now all grown up and have moved out of home. His wife died a few years ago. And I think he's much more vulnerable than he was in the past and more reflective about the past.
You also spoke to some of Ivor's children, his daughter Judy.
Mum told me when I was 10 years old, I just remember going into a corner of the room and just sobbing my heart out. And from that moment on, I did not feel I was able to go to him when I was upset because I didn't want to. And it was also Mum would often say as well, she would say, you know, don't upset Dad, you know, Dad's been through enough. I do understand and I've accepted that I won't be able to release my demons because I can't until he has.
A lot of the children of survivors that I met had had a very similar experience to Judy. They weren't told directly by their survivor parent about what had happened to them. They started to learn small details almost by mistake, and they didn't know what to do with those details, and they felt that they couldn't ask questions. So Judy felt she could never talk to Ivor, and Judy's mother would tell her not to, and she would tell the children, you know, when they misbehaved in the way that children do, you know, not to misbehave because Ivor had been through so much and had suffered enough in life. And for a normal 12-year-old child, that's a very difficult thing to hear. And it's very difficult to have a normal childhood in that way. And I think once they had got through their childhoods without really asking their parents about it or their parents about it, they often didn't until decades later. And I found a lot of survivors, rather children of survivors, only started talking about it properly in their 40s, 50s, you know, much more recently.
So we're talking about long-term trauma for children of survivors as well.
Second-generation trauma. Judy has two older sisters and a younger brother, and all of them at one time or another have suffered with their mental health, and they feel that that's a direct result of Ivor and the Holocaust.
At the top of the segment, we talked about the current moment that we're in and why this documentary is particularly meaningful today. And there has been a rise of anti-Semitism, hate crimes, not just here in the United States, but around much of the world. When the Holocaust survivors that you interview see this, what do they say?
I think they find it incredibly difficult to deal with. One comfort that Holocaust survivors had in the past was that maybe the world they were leaving would be a better one than the one that they lived through. And yet, as you say, the rise in anti-Semitism, the rise in the far right, continued genocide in Burma, Holocaust denial is being on the rise. All of these things are things that they're very conscious of, and I think they find very, very difficult to deal with. So in many ways, that's probably contributed to the trauma for them.
Do you find them overall optimistic about what the future holds, given their experience?
I think, you know, they're extraordinary people, and the majority of survivors that I met were incredibly optimistic people with a great sense of humour and were positive about the future, but they also felt this sense of responsibility to do something with their status as Holocaust survivors. And I think the world's looking to them more and more because they're conscious that survivors won't be with us for much longer. So they certainly felt a comfort knowing that after they were gone, this film would endure and there'd be an opportunity for future generations to hear their testimonies and to, you know, learn valuable lessons from it.
Arthur Carey is the director of Frontline's The Last Survivor. Arthur, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much.
The Last Survivors airs on PBS tomorrow. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.